Good morning, New Mexico, and welcome to the Santa Fe Radio Cafe. My name is Mary Charlotte. We're broadcasting from the Santa Fe Baking Company on Cordova Road and streaming on the web at ksfr.org. We are podcasting at the website santafe.radiocafe.org, where you can hear the show whenever you want, thanks to Santa Fe's .foil computer services. You can subscribe to the show on iTunes, and you can find us at facebook.com/radiocafe. I'd like now to welcome John Deere. He is a Jesuit priest. He is a peace activist, nonviolence activist. He is the author of many books, the latest of which is an autobiography called A Persistent Peace, One Man's Struggle for a Nonviolent World. And he is part of an evening called Witness for Peace this coming Friday, July 31st, an evening with two Nobel Peace Prize winners at 7 o'clock at the Santa Fe Convention Center. Jody Williams and Mairead McGuire will be there, and we'll talk more about that in a little while. Welcome to the Radio Cafe.
Thanks for having me, Mary Charlotte.
It's wonderful to have you on the show once again. And it's a great privilege to read your wonderful autobiography, which is, although it's long, is a gripping read, and I guess it was much longer before you edited it down to, what, 300 or 400 pages?
Yeah, that's right. I wrote almost 1,000 pages. I don't know what came over me, but I've had a really adventurous in life. I'm just turning 50 now, so I wanted to put it all down while I remembered. Anyway, all the publishers couldn't handle a book that long, and eventually this one cut it in half. I wanted to write it like a Robert Ludlum thriller, you know, a spiritual journey and adventures in peacemaking and nonviolence, and I think it turns out pretty well. And it ends in New Mexico in Santa Fe.
That's right. Like many books written by religious people, there is a childhood, which you don't write that much about, but your father was a newspaper man and you became a news junkie in the 60s, and it was then that you saw the horrors of what was happening in Vietnam and in the United States and race riots and things like that, and that's where you got politicized and turned toward social justice.
Well, unfortunately, a lot of that got cut from the book, and I just mention it in passing, but I grew up in North Carolina, and then I guess when I was about 10, I moved to Washington, D.C., and my father was one of the heads of the National Press Club. We had a big family newspaper business, and so I was hanging out among the media in Washington, D.C., and that meant politicians, and it was quite an exposure from an early age. And we were very politicized and talking about the media every day growing up in this family. And so we suddenly were talking civil rights and the Vietnam War, and I, you know, was ingrained with that. I remember, for example, when Martin Luther King was killed, my parents woke me up at 5 in the morning. They said, "You got to get up. We got to talk about this." The next morning, I was just 10 years old or something like that. And then my dad took me downtown to see the riots. And then a couple months later, he took me downtown, if you remember, the Poor People's Campaign, which became Resurrection City, but it was a disaster after King's death. And he drove me there, and we walked through the big fields of thousands of poor people came. This is now after the death of Bobby Kennedy, and my dad said, "I want you to remember this." And I think he regrets it, because I certainly remembered it and took it to heart. And it sowed the seeds of me thinking about, what's the meaning of life? And I thought, Martin Luther King was only 39 when he was killed, and Bobby Kennedy was like 42. And they tried so hard, and they got killed, and then it set me on a deep spiritual journey to discover, what does life mean, and what do we do in the face of death and a world of death? And that's what led me to my crisis in college, which I write about, and led me to the Jesuits, and led me on the path to peace.
It made me think about what's a privileged childhood, because in common ways of thinking, a privileged childhood is you get to sail boats and have nice stuff and go to the beach. But in a way, you had the most privileged childhood because you were exposed to the biggest and most important ideas, namely social justice, the big wide world of human beings outside of your little community, and the struggle which nobody really knows the answer to, of how to respond. Everybody has to come up with their own way of responding to injustice.
That's so interesting. Writing the book, for me, was a journey to reflect on my own life and to find out, how did I end up like I did? And I grew up in a beautiful area in the Outer Banks of North Carolina. But my dad was also involved early in the civil rights movements, and I saw crosses burned. My dad had death threats from the Klan for supporting the Kennedys in North Carolina. threats against me as a little boy and my older brother. We were going to be kidnapped and killed, the Klan said. I think that did something to me. But what happened was moving to D.C. and being with these people, and I mean real major government people, senators, congresspeople. I played football, for example, every Sunday with Roger Mudd, who was the CBS anchor at the time. And I saw how empty the whole thing was. It was all so corrupt. And so these days, friends are saying, no, we got to, I shouldn't say this even, you know, lobby, get involved in the system. I just don't even want to go there because I know from my childhood, from inside, that our system is really broken and we need something much deeper. That's what I was looking for from the heroes of Dr. King and Bobby Kennedy. Does that make sense?
Yeah, I mean, I found it interesting that Bobby Kennedy was such an influence on you and how Bobby Kennedy changed after his brother was assassinated is something that you write about.
Yeah, and again, I wrote much more, didn't make into the book. That's because I identified with him, coming from an upper-class, white, Catholic family and going to be involved in doing good in the world. And I see him changing, and then he gets killed. And so I was really upset by that as a boy. And then later, while I was at Duke, I went to work for the Kennedys. While I was going through this change and at the Robert Kennedy Memorial Foundation. And I only did it for a while. I worked as an assistant to Bobby Kennedy's best friend, a great guy named David Hackett, who's still alive and just an amazing person. And so I learned about what do you do? How do you make the world a better place? And I chose a path to I really was deliberately trying to get the deeper spiritual roots of the journey. And the God question and the meaning of life and death, as well as trying to make the world a better place. You know, does that make sense? You know? And that led me on this journey into nonviolence. And I feel like I'm on a whole new path now, you know, that few have chosen. I shouldn't say that, but that's the way it feels, you know, nowadays.
Well, it was in college at a pretty young age that while they were having keg parties at the fraternity, you were having deep questions about the nature of God and whether there was God, and you had kind of a, I guess in the tradition of everybody from St. Augustine on, a kind of a conversion experience.
Right, and actually I rejected God and went for the keg parties.
Right.
Yeah, and I was at Duke University in the late 1970s, and it was an incredible place to be. It still is, and it's wild. It's wilder than any other place
like
in the
country. Like a party school, you mean?
Yeah, and it's beyond all the other party schools, and you also have these incredibly bright people. The guy in the room next to me was my childhood friend, Paul Farmer, the doctor who's now maybe the mythic doctor in the whole world, who invented Partners for Health and works in Haiti and Rwanda. So we were both in this fraternity studying all day and partying till dawn for years. And I thought, okay, what am I going to do with my life? I'll be a newspaper publisher like my father. No, I'll be a lawyer like my friends. No, I really want to be a rock star. That's what I, because I loved music. And I was really serious about it. And recording and going to recording studios, going to record companies, the whole thing.
I love that.
Yeah. And then I thought, well, I had this experience working at this place doing volunteer work with disabled people in North Carolina State Home for the Criminally Insane, it was called. Just an awful place. And I was so upset and shaken by these very poor people locked behind bars for the rest of their lives and getting to know them and being very moved and, you know, discovering compassion and also learning from them about not just suffering, but what does it mean? What is the meaning of life? And then I'd go home to the fraternity.
Right.
We have the richest and the best and the brightest carrying on. All went on to become great millionaires, except for Paul. And I had this existential crisis in front of me. And I said, well, what am I going to do? And where is God in all this? And then I thought, there is no God. And so
in this home for the criminally insane, you saw neglect and beauty and horror and compassion and everything that was invisible to most of your peers.
Well, it was the former North Carolina military barracks. There's 7 miles of hallway in this place. It was 100 years old. And there were hundreds of patients. And up until like the year before I was there, they had all they used to do was just do frontal lobotomies on everybody. So the poverty and they're charged with serious felony convictions. So they're locked behind prisons. So it was like the poorest of the poor in the United States. course, all African American. And the contrast was very sharp. So I decided there is no God, and I might leave the church and won't believe in God and make as much money as you want. But then I thought, well, if there's no meaning to life, why not be as violent as you want and support war and nuclear weapons? And basically, as I write in my autobiography, A Persistent Peace, I came to the conclusion one day that, oh, of course I believe in God, and God is a God of love, and the whole universe is created for love and peace, and we're all going to go to this great reign of God, which is all about loving with all 100 billion people who ever lived. And my next thought was, well, this is all or nothing then. You got to give your whole life. This short life is short. We're going to die, and God's going to say, I'm so happy to see you, and what did you do to help my suffering people? And I thought, I have to give my whole life to God. And my next thought was, oh, my God, I'm going to have to become a Jesuit.
Oh, my God.
Yes, because I had gone to a Jesuit high school in Washington, D.C., and I was not impressed. But I knew of Daniel Berrigan, and I knew of this great Jesuit in El Salvador who had been assassinated for standing up for the poor, and they impressed me. And so that was all I knew. These were kind of like frontline priests for justice for the poorest of the poor of the world. And I thought, well, that makes sense. You know, that's the best of Catholicism and Christianity, Daniel Berrigan from the 1960s and 70s, who's still alive today, by the way, at age 88. Anyway, and I just let it all go, and here I am today.
There's an interesting moment where when you realize you had to let it all go, you started to think about what is the nature of self-sacrifice, and you started doing things, thinking not about what you needed for yourself, but instead doing things for others, and you went through a process that I think kind of goes against the later sort of Joseph Campbell follow your bliss way of thinking.
Right, which is an old tradition in Christian mysticism, and it's, you're right, it goes against New Age spirituality, it goes against Joseph Campbell, it goes against all our modern pop psychology, which is deny yourself, unconditionally love everybody, put yourself second, third, and just give, give, give.
So what was the experience of doing that like?
Well, I was just writing, this was after right after that conversion, because my whole life is selfishness, and Duke was this training camp in selfishness, really. And the best and the brightest, make as much money, get ahead, and it's especially for white males. So I was trying to practice that on an interpersonal level, and for those who are Catholics who are listening, this is the ultimate saint of this is Saint Thérèse of Lisieux from the 1800s of France. She's known as the Little Flower. And I, looking at it from the perspective of Mahatma Gandhi now, looked at Thérèse became an expert, a scientist in interpersonal nonviolence, which we're not good at here in the United States, and especially in families, which are so violent. We're all so broken. And you're just going to be completely nonviolent to everybody around you and put the others first. We could talk about what we've learned about psychology and, you know, maybe you got to deal with your anger and so forth and so on. But that was new for me. And I began to read the lives of the saints, and I thought, oh, I better be nice to the people around me. And I'm still struggling with that. But what then happened was while I was doing that, I ended up going to, before I entered the Jesuits, to Israel to see the Holy Land, to see where Jesus lived. And long story short, I hope people will get my book and read about it. But
ladies and gentlemen, it's a really good book.
And the Israel invaded Lebanon while I was there, or just before, and this horrible war went on, all of it orchestrated out of the Pentagon, which 60,000 people were killed in 3 months. All the tour groups were canceled. Me, a dopey 21-year-old kid, roaming around, backpacking, hitchhiking through Israel, camping out at the Sea of Galilee, oblivious to everything that's going on. I'm thinking deep thoughts about Jesus and love. Until one day I saw the jets swoop down over the Sea of Galilee near the Chapel of the Beatitudes, where Jesus, we commemorate the Sermon on the Mount where Jesus said, love your enemies. I saw all these bombs fall. And the next day I went up to the border and I saw 10,000 soldiers, actually with my own physical eyes, barreling into Lebanon. And it changed my life. And I realized you can't just be a nice person and do your interpersonal nonviolence and love and charity work. My goal was to be a pious Jesuit, which I joke is an oxymoron, but that was my plan. You have to also work to end evil and war and injustice and nuclear weapons and expand the gospel to promote a universal love which means an entire new we're pursuing a whole new nonviolent world without war, poverty, nuclear weapons, and global warming. So I had a kind of a second conversion, and it was sort of unpacking the political implications of the first, if you see what I mean.
Right.
And gosh, I'm still recovering from that, too, and still on the journey.
We're talking to Father John Deere. His book is called A Persistent Peace, One Man's Struggle for a Nonviolent World. And he is part of the evening Witness for Peace, which is this Friday, July 31st, at the Santa Fe Convention Center with Nobel Prize winners Jody Williams and Mairead McGuire. We'll talk about that more in a few minutes. So you had these two conversion experiences. One is about God, love, and Jesus. The second is about having to take action in the world. And your parents were not very happy about your becoming a priest. There had been priests in the family who'd become disillusioned with the church and whatnot. You went into the whole Jesuit world and found that not everybody felt the same way that you did, that passion for social justice and really making the world a better place.
Yes, and it was on the one hand, it was a great disappointment, but on the other hand, I knew that. Because, well, we all see it playing out around us today, how the church is just mirroring the culture. Not just the scandals. I'm talking about all the churches as well, supporting Bush's war in Iraq. It's church people building nuclear weapons at Los Alamos and working at Sandia and Kirkland. It's church people who are running apartheid. And we could go on and on. But within the Jesuits, there were mythic heroes, the epitome being Daniel Berrigan. But that's true in all the religions and in every corner of society. There are these great activists. I just made the most of it, Mary Charlotte. I befriended Father Daniel Berrigan, and he became my teacher. And I knew what I was getting into, and he kind of taught me from his mistakes. And I watched how he just kept at it. The interesting thing about Dan is that he never gave up, even though he was so famous in the 60s and the 70s. He was on the front page of the New York Times every day at one point for over a year. And then he just was dropped by the media. But he's still on the journey. And he's still as committed as ever, now at age 88. And so I decided early on that what we need are people committed to the struggle for peace and justice for the long haul. My parents didn't understand. They still don't understand, nor does my family. And I made a lot of mistakes on the way. But we're all learning and growing, and you know, we're all on this journey of life to death and toward new life and the God of peace, I hope.
One thing that was and is very important to you is the way that the United States and my payroll tax dollars and everybody's tax dollars get spent, basically training soldiers from other countries. In the 80s, it was Central America, to attack their own people in horrible ways, and you were on the front lines witnessing that, trying to get the word out and protesting it.
Yes, and you see, but you know, I was thinking coming over here, you know, that I'm really ultimately not just a protester or an activist. I'm trying to find the spiritual roots of peace. And in my journey, I've studied Gandhi and Dr. King and Dorothy Day, and then knowing the Berrigans and great people like Mother Teresa or Archbishop Tutu, there's a great way of life, which was to be human is to be nonviolent, loving, peaceful, and to promote justice for the poor, and as I said, to work for a new world of nonviolence. And not only that, this is the spiritual life. For the Christian, Jesus is nonviolent, and he's just saying that God is a God of nonviolence and peace and justice. Well, this changes everything. Then I look at the world, and I see 35 wars, 25,000 nuclear weapons, a billion people starving, global warming, or death squads in El Salvador from my personal experience in the 80s. And you got to do something. But it's part of the spiritual journey toward peace, the new world of peace, and the God of peace. So what happened to me, and I write about it at length, was we were getting these desperate letters from the great heroic Jesuits of El Salvador and Central America in the 80s to us in the United States, do something to stop your government from killing our people. Well, I asked to go and live there and eventually did in 1985 under the direction of these great Jesuits who were later assassinated in 1989. It was 20 years ago this November.
Now, under what circumstances were you there? You were not yet an
ordained
priest.
No, I was a Jesuit scholastic. I was a dopey gringo kid, you know, like a seminarian. We call it Jesuit scholastic. There were a group of us, And these tough guys at this great university sent us each out on our own to these horrible, terrible, beautiful refugee camps in the heart of the war zones. You know, and here I'm interested in peace and nonviolence, and suddenly I'm right in the middle of the height of the Salvadoran War, 1985. And the theory was, because there were like 10, as I remember, North Americans in the whole country when I was there. I knew them all, except for, of course, the U.S. military.
CIA. I was going to say the CIA advisors.
Yeah, they were all church people. The idea was when the death squads came into the camp, they would send me and my other Jesuit friend out to talk to them. The hope was, and they said this to me, maybe they'll kill you instead, or maybe they won't kill us because you're here. And they didn't, because it was a scandal. But meanwhile, the bombs were falling around, and the rebels were marching around, and the people were starving. It was incredible, and it changed my life again. And I know now that El Salvador is a parable of the whole world. The whole world has become El Salvador now, and the U.S. is involved. We have 740 military bases around the planet. I'm talking about the Obama administration, with no real movement toward getting rid of them. We have to continue this. So it was a very profound experience. And that was just my journey toward peace, involved El Salvador and these great Jesuits who were later killed.
How did you respond at the time? Because, I mean, I remember that time, and one of the problems that everybody faced, both in groups and on a personal level, was the sense of rage and powerlessness against the killing machine and against the money machine that was providing millions of dollars every day toward death squads and so on. How did you make choices and decisions about how to stand up against this and do something that you felt was effective?
Well, I don't know about the word effective, and we can talk about that, because that's actually my problem. That's what I mean about talking about something deeper, and I hope that's not a cop-out or a bourgeois thing. I'm still struggling with that question. How does one make a difference in the world? Well, when you look from Jesus to Gandhi and Dorothy Day, you have to spend time prayer and meditation, and you ask the God of peace, what do you want me to do? You got to work through your own violence and fears and make choices toward nonviolence. You got to get with a group, and you got to take some public action. But I'm very committed to the vision of a global grassroots movement for peace and justice. In the end, I think that's the only way change happens. From the abolitionists to the suffragists to the labor movement, the civil rights movement, the anti-war movement, and now the environmental movement. The only way change happens is through bottom-up grassroots peoples of every stripe, not just church people, but lawyers, doctors, media, everybody, saying we're going to get involved in a movement and we are going to force the governments to change. And we see that from the Berlin Wall and communism falling to South Africa and all the changes that have happened in the last 30 years. So I went to Salvador to learn, but I came back, you know, emboldened to act, and got involved with Salvadorans in the States, got involved with peace and justice groups, and took action and organized demonstrations and gave talks and led prayer services. I'm still doing that today. That's why I'm going to Los Alamos on Saturday. We have to do things. And the peace movement has to, I mean, people in these peace movements, we have to keep at it. That's why I'm saying this is a life journey and this is a spiritual journey. And the thing that you learn, Mary Charlotte, that I've learned, is you're not effective, to use your word. I mean, I've made it a change. Things are much worse. I'm a complete failure with my life, you could argue. And Daniel Berrigan says this to me privately all the time. At age 88, he's given his whole life. I'm an ex-con too, and I don't see, you know, what good. Well, then, what are you doing? Well, it's a way of life. You're living a vision of nonviolence. You're sowing seeds. You're part of building a movement that hopefully, whether you live to see it or not, will help end war and nuclear weapons and poverty. And it's, in the end, it's God's work. It's God's work, not mine.
I mean, you didn't end war, but the war and military aid to El Salvador did end, and the pressure brought by grassroots groups was part of that.
Actually, it was. And in the early Christians, in the first 300 years of the early Christians, they were radical people of nonviolence. You could have nothing to do with war or Empire Caesar if you were going to follow this guy. But then the church created the just war theory, and we've been off track ever since. Well, they used to say, the blood of the martyrs sows the seeds of peace. In other words, it brings down empire and ends war and brings justice for the people. Well, what happened was when the six Jesuits were killed in 1989, it was such a shock to the whole church and peace movement in the United States that people put enormous pressure on Congress. And several congressmen told me since then that in the last 40 years, the most lobbying that ever happened was within 6 months after the death of the Jesuits. There were millions of calls, led mainly by nuns, by the way, and it just shut down Congress and made them cut off military aid to El Salvador, and then the war has to end because we're funding all the wars around the world. Well, the death of the Jesuits literally began the process of peace, and it's a strange, strange thing that this nonviolence works.
I think one of the lessons, one of the many lessons from that whole story is the incredible effectiveness of shutting down offices through masses of telephone calls, which is a lot more effective than signing petitions on the internet.
Well, I don't know, Mary Charlotte. I think it's all good. We have to try everything we can to put pressure on our government to stop U.S. military aid everywhere and our wars and our nuclear weapons. We need to do everything. But, you know, in the end, civil disobedience is really what can really tip the scales. And if you study the history of the movements, it's when people put so much pressure and stop the business of war making that the change happens. So nonviolent direct action, if it's meticulously nonviolent and aimed, in the end, it has to work. It will bear good fruit because it wears down people and it opens people's heart. And in the end, they're just going to give in to our demands. But it has to be really nonviolent.
We're talking to Father John Deere. There is a very interesting moment in the book in which you were talking to somebody who is a spiritual person who's asking you how you pray. And you said, well, I pray for half an hour every morning, and I tell God to end the war in El Salvador and cut off military aid and so on. You go through this long thing of what you tell God that you want. And she looks at you and very compassionately says, is that how you talk to someone you love? You harangue them and make demands in an angry way for 30 minutes every day for 10 years. And that changed, that reframed your whole sense of prayer and meditation.
Right. Well, and it's embarrassing to tell that story, but I'm a learner. I'm a beginner. I'm just a novice at all of this. I still am. And so I write about that because that was a big breakthrough. In the Jesuits, you know, they teach you this beautiful spirituality going back to St. Ignatius from the 1540s. He was worlds ahead of his time, which is you use your imagination. Imagine you're sitting with Jesus and listen to him and then tell him your problems and try to follow him. It's very clever and beautiful. And this was unheard of at the time. It was all monasticism or Franciscanism. So, okay. So I'm trained in this, and you take quiet time for prayer every day and daily mass and an 8-day retreat every year and a 30-day retreat every 40 few years, and the whole point is to get out into the world and work for justice and peace. Okay, so I'm out there, I'm on the front lines, I'm getting arrested, I'm mad at Reagan, and I want to end the war in El Salvador, and every day for my morning prayer, I'd sit down and say, God, you've got to end these wars and nuclear weapons, and after 30 minutes, I'd say, well, that was a very successful prayer period. This went on for years. Yeah. It's just pathetic. Now, I don't think this is most people's problem, but this is just what happened to me. And it's the story of a lot of activists, you know, being very angry. It's the lesson of the 60s that angry activism for peace doesn't work and it won't sustain you. Well, I had this great spiritual director. She was my guru. I was a Dominican nun that I write about. And after listening to me for 6 months, she said, John, that's not the way we speak to somebody we love. Prayer for the Christian, I'm just speaking as a Christian now, is of a relationship. Imagine the person who loved you most during your life, maybe your mother or your grandmother, the one person who was unconditionally loving. And our theory is that the God of peace is a billion times more loving, just crazy in love with each one of us, in fact, all 100 billion, who wants to be with you and love you. And so for 10 years, you could say, I'm just going and yelling at this loving God. And eventually, you know, not only would it hurt God's feelings, but why would God want to be with me? So I began to understand. And you learn that prayer is a journey of a loving relationship, of listening to God, sharing with God, of moving to be with the one who loves you, and then eventually just moving toward being in love. Well, that's what all the saints, that's what Gandhi, that's what the monks are all about. Even in Buddhism, it's eventually just being in perfect peace. But for the Christian, it's living in a relationship with Jesus. So Ignatius was still right, but there's no reason to yell or angry take out on this loving God who's calling me to be part of a journey. So I'm still working on that today. Or I shouldn't say working on it. I'm still trying to live a life in relationship, for me as a Christian, with this nonviolent Jesus. Share my life with him. That's how I pray. And let him disarm me, if you will. It's a real journey toward inner disarmament of the roots of war in me, and so that then I can become an instrument of his peace and really have something to offer to the world instead of the usual anger, which doesn't work.
Well, this whole question of what does and doesn't work and in what circumstances it does and doesn't work is a very long conversation. But
yes.
I mean, you did a lot of civil disobedience.
Uh-huh.
You got arrested. You spent time in jail. You went through kangaroo courts that were stacked against
Unbelievable.
You.
Unbelievable, yeah.
Tell us some of those stories.
Are you leading up to say what good did it all do or something?
I don't know. I mean, that's a...
Well, let me say that, something about that, and I'll tell a story or two. But and why I wrote the book, A Persistent Peace, is... I've come to the conclusion, this is really basic, because I'm such a novice at this, is that life is a journey. Life is a spiritual journey to peace, to being peaceful with myself, with everybody I meet, with everybody on the planet, and walking a road to peace, living and breathing in peace, for me being with the peacemaking Jesus, and working for and heading toward a new world of peace and the God of peace. And so... all this stuff, when you read my story, and I'm around the world in war zones and refugee camps or meeting famous people or poor people and in jail, it's all one for me. It's a journey, if you see what I mean. Whereas, and I don't even think of just one particular action. And then I came to the conclusion, looking, if you will, like a Gandhian hermeneutic of life. Life is a journey from violence to nonviolence. And I began to reflect on my own violence. And being part of the culture of violence, and how can I become more and more nonviolent? And I really urge people to do this, to reflect on your life as a movement from violence to nonviolence, and to make a decision that from this day till your last day on earth, you're going to go deeper, deeper, deeper into nonviolence. And it just is such a transforming way to look at life. Again, this is a Gandhian way to understand your life, whether you're a Christian or whatever religion or no religion, it helps unpack your humanity. So these actions are Gandhian Christian experiments to see whether I can do this. I'm doing my inner work. I'm trying to do my interpersonal work. And what do you do with the world? Well, if you hang out with Daniel and Philip Berrigan, eventually you're going to cross the line and break the laws which legalize mass murder. And I guess I've told many stories here before, but the most famous being the Plowshares Action from 1993 with Phil. We walked onto this big military base in North Carolina at 4 in the morning. We came up to a big F-15E, and we got out a hammer, and we hammered once or twice in this huge fighter bomber. Totally ridiculous. And we said to the judge, hey, I'm just doing what the Bible said. Isaiah said someday people are going to come along and beat their swords into plowshares. And the judge was like, look, are you crazy? And we're just playing with the scripture and the text, and total cognitive dissonance. And Phil said that courtroom scene, we were in and out of court for 6 months. I was faced 20 years in prison for that action. I was convicted of 2 felony counts, each getting 10 years in prison. Many judges and prosecutors have told me since I'm as high up a terrorist as you can get in the country because I was involved with nuclear weapons. But in that courtroom in Elizabeth City, North Carolina, as I write in the book, it was incredible because the jury, the prosecutor, the judge, all had connections with the military base and the police, the whole town. And actually, it was so providential. That was the town that I was born and raised, too. So my whole life was coming together. And I remember going into one jail, and this jailer said to me, you know, I used to babysit for you as a kid. You know, he's leading me around in chains, and the media is following me around. And it was unbelievable. And the judge just had so much hatred for Phil and I. Why? I think he was really threatened. You've got a priest standing up and saying, hey, this is wrong. We shouldn't be killing people. We shouldn't be making bombs. Not only is this immoral, this is ungodly. And it's sinful and demonic. And we were fearlessly saying to him, we were in all the media and the New York Times even. And it touched a nerve. I also think they understand nonviolence better than we do. Because they know that if ordinary people, priests, nuns, grandparents, students, stand up, walk into military bases, go to Los Alamos and say, no more killing, no more bombs, they got a problem. Because this is going to get contagious. And so we got to nip that in the bud. And that's why they cracked down on people like us. It was powerful. And as Dan always said, well, at least it ain't dull.
Well, there you are in a courtroom full of people who hate you, subject to the whims of not only the law, but of their perhaps prejudices or just power to put you in a box for the rest of your life or for the next 20 years. Were you able to generate Jesus's pure love and peace inside of yourself?
Well, it's a journey, Mary Charlotte. And that's the journey, to generate Jesus's pure love and peace.
Yeah, but at a certain point, the journey stops and there you are in the moment.
I guess I'd say it wasn't like that. Yeah. And I would say the journey doesn't stop, and the journey is continuing this very moment. I'm still working on that, trying to be in that place of where Jesus is practicing pure love and peace within me. So the thing about a plowshares action, including, I would say, I hope all public peace and justice actions, if they're going to be nonviolent, and I've learned this from Dr. King and Dr. King's friends, you have to prepare, and you have to do nonviolence training. We're experts at violence, and we have to really, really work at responding nonviolently. Well, I worked for years with our little group because we were preparing to be shot and killed. And then we were preparing for 20 years in prison, and we were preparing to deal with soldiers with machine guns and judges. And that all came true.
Yeah.
So, you know, if you keep rehearsing and practicing, it begins to wear off and become more natural. So that wasn't a big issue for me, you know. When I was in that courtroom, I was really at deep, deep, profound peace. And in fact, people said to me, from media people to relatives to police officers, they were frightened of me because I was so peaceful.
Interesting.
And I didn't know what they were talking about. I look at back now and I understand more and more.
And they asked you who was driving the car, and you said the Holy Spirit.
Yeah, because it was just so centered and peaceful, and I'm just way beyond anger. I'm trying to enter deeply into universal nonviolent love and to give my love for the human race. The guy I follow was killed nonviolently. I just figured this is part of the job description. They have to go deeper. So, the bigger challenge for me is always church people, you know, who can be so mean and warlike. And I'm still struggling with priests, bishops today. It's the police officers and judges and people who build nuclear weapons I expect to be mean and violent, you know. It's those who are supposed to be following the nonviolent Jesus who give me a challenge.
Well, you were what would you call it, exiled to New Mexico at a certain point.
Yeah, I write all about this in my book, and I'm very happy to be here, and I love New Mexico, but it wasn't my choice to come here. You know, I was living in New York City, living in a great Jesuit community with Daniel Berrigan. I was the director of the Fellowship of Reconciliation, the largest interfaith peace group in the world. And I had just stepped down. I was kind of burnt out from the work. And September 11th happened, and I went down and volunteered, and the Red Cross asked me to coordinate all the chaplains at the Family Center. So I was really involved in that and working at Ground Zero. It was a horrific experience. And then with my friends, organizing demonstrations in Times Square against the bombing of Afghanistan. It was quite a life, and it was nonstop throughout the fall of 2001. And then I was writing about it, and the New York Times wrote about me, you know, what is this guy doing working with the relatives and being against the war? This is too confusing. I was saying love your neighbor and love your enemies, as for the Christian response. It's not just we have to care for our New Yorkers. We're all grieving. We can't kill anybody else in retaliation. This isn't going to this is just going to breed further terrorist acts, and we've seen that play out now. Well, anyway, the Jesuits had so many complaints. I got called in and kicked out of New York. And I put about that in the book. The Jesuits almost stopped me from putting that book, from putting that in. And many other episodes were taken out because I've just been in so much trouble for speaking out against war, nuclear weapons, as a church person. Well, anyway, they said you can go anywhere in the country you want. But if you don't, you know, we're going to send you to teach sophomore religion in Philadelphia in 3 months. So I had friends here in New Mexico. They said, come here. So I came out here and was a pastor for several years up in Cimarron and Springer. And then when the Bush War got, you know, really underway, I've been traveling the country full time for the last few years, speaking out against war to churches and universities, to hundreds of thousands of people, actually, and writing books and working mainly on this autobiography. And then I went on a big book tour for the book. And continuing to, with Pax Christi New Mexico, try to build a church movement here in New Mexico to say no to nuclear weapons at Los Alamos. And that's why we're gathering this weekend again to commemorate Hiroshima. So I'm you know, it's all providential for me. It's all a journey. I'm trying to take it all nonviolently. I expect trouble. You know, if you're going to speak out for peace in a culture of war, it's not going to go over well. And it's going to test your nonviolence, and you're going to get kicked around, and your family and your world is going to be disrupted. That's all in the job description. And but I'm happy to be here and to continue organizing and speaking.
One of the reasons that you wrote the book was because there are so many stories in it. One story that we were just talking about was you're going to Iraq in the late 90s and meeting these high school girls who said, why do you hate us so?
Yeah, I was saying, you know, there's just so many powerful experiences I've had. And when you travel the war zones of the world, your heart's just broken over and over again to see what your country is doing. And in 1999, with Mairead Maguire, my friend, the Nobel laureate from Belfast, who'll be here Friday night in Santa Fe, we wrote to all the Nobel Peace Prize winners and invited them on an all-expense-paid trip to Iraq to see for ourselves the effects of the U.S.-UN sanctions, which we know now killed 500,000 children throughout the 90s. I would say now the United States has been involved in the death of 1.7 million Iraqi civilians since 1990. It's just unfathomable. Well, so we were the highest level delegation to go into Iraq. We were only a small group, and there were only two Nobel laureates. But we met everybody. And from all the UN officials, we almost met Saddam. We met every nonprofit group. We met with the doctors. We met hundreds of dying children. And it was overwhelming and heartbreaking. But I was mentioning to you earlier that the thing that stays with me was we were brought to meet this high school high school kids in downtown Baghdad. Well, it turned out to be a girls' high school. And we pull up on a Thursday morning at 10 a.m., and there were 500 high school girls standing in silence waiting for us, looking at us. And we get out of the car, and we're standing on the sidewalk, and they're looking at us really intently. I mean, that's something to see. I mean, if you think about high school girls in silence. And they charged us. But first they sang. They were prepared for our coming, and they broke into song, singing in Arabic, "We shall overcome," the Civil Rights Peace Movement. In Arabic, in honor of the FOR and the Nobel. Then they burst into tears, all 500 of them, and then they charged us. And I had 100 girls charge me, and one shouted out, "Why do you want to kill us? What have we done to you? We want to be friends with the kids in America." And then this one girl looked at me and said, this is 1999, "We love Britney too." You know, I spent 3 hours with Tariq Aziz, but I remember that poor girl's statement, and she was crying. You know, "We just want to be kids." And I think of them now, and I think most of them are probably dead and their lives destroyed. And I've worked ever since then to end the U.S. war in Iraq, and now the U.S. war in Afghanistan, which continues, the war continues under Obama, and the peace movement has got to continue to put pressure on the government to end the war in Iraq, Afghanistan, Pakistan, and all our wars and our weapons. For people like those beautiful girls that I met.
You're also about to go to Darfur.
Yes. I'm working on that's why I say it's a journey that never ends, Mary Charlotte. And I have an invitation through these heroic Jesuits who've spent 40 years in the Sudan and the Congo, who basically set up the modern refugee camp, if you could call it that, the Jesuit Refugee Service, which is a terrific organization. And they've invited me to bring me in, perhaps illegally even, into Darfur and the Congo in January, and Uganda. And so I'm probably going to go. It looks like it's going to happen.
Meanwhile, this Friday, the 31st of July, at 7 o'clock at the Santa Fe Convention Center, Jody Williams and Mairead McGuire will be speaking. These are both Nobel Peace Prize laureates. Tell us just briefly about each one of them.
Well, if I could just say that, you know, why we keep doing this and what Jody and Mairead are going to say is, okay, earlier this year, President Obama said the future is a nuclear-free world. Now, we have to support that vision. The problem was, he said, unfortunately, it won't happen in our lifetime. Not only are we saying it has to happen in our lifetime, it has to happen now. We can't afford these weapons, besides the fact they're so immoral and impractical. So we're going to call upon people to put more pressure on the Obama administration in this key year, as the Comprehensive Test Ban Treaty is going to be up for ratification, and all this other talk is going on right now about what do we do with nuclear weapons, and he wants to cut them, you know, down in numbers, and it's going to affect Los Alamos and Sandia and Kirkland. But as people of faith, we are saying, the future is a world without nuclear weapons, and it's a world of nonviolence. And what happened was last year we had Sister Helen Prejean. She was great, and she talked about, hey, New Mexico, you've got to abolish the death penalty. But Los Alamos puts the whole world on a global death row. You've got to abolish nuclear weapons. It was incredible, her talk.
And we did abolish.
And we did it. And we've been part of that movement. But we've got to hear Helen's message to us, that it's all one, all this form of violence. Well, we weren't sure we were going to do this every year because we're getting old and tired. And then Mairead called me and said, John, I hope you don't mind, but I've invited all the Nobel Peace Prize winners to come to Los Alamos with you and your friends to sit in sackcloth and ashes and to say, we've got to close Los Alamos, or at least disarm it and get rid of these weapons once for all. So in the end, Mairead is bringing Jody Williams, and they'll be speaking Friday night at the convention center. Now, Jody Williams is the great heroic organizer. Her story is unbelievable. Out of Vermont in the late 1990s, before all of us were on the internet, she just got it in her head she's going to work to get rid of landmines. And she organized 95 nations to, I don't even know how to say it, end landmines. Signed this treaty in Oslo in September 1997. She won the Nobel Peace Prize for it, and she deserves it. She's the ultimate organizer. Everyone should come to see not just this heroic woman. Every woman in Santa Fe should be there to see these two great women. But if you're an activist, you care about what to do, come and hear Jody teach us how to organize. Mairead, to my mind, is the greatest teacher, a living teacher of nonviolence in the world. I remember Andrew Young said that she's the only person that reminds him of Martin Luther King, that nonviolence is in her DNA. And her story is unbelievable. Her sister was walking down the street with some of her children, her nephew and nieces. In 1976, a British soldier opened fire on the driver of a car and shot and killed the driver because he knew he was with the IRA. The car keeps going, plows into the sidewalk, and kills Mairead's nieces and nephew, and her sister later died too. That day, Mairead called upon all the women, mainly of Northern Ireland, to march for peace. And for the next 6 months, the war ended, much to the chagrin of all the men on both sides of the issue,
right,
that these uppity women were saying, that's it. And not only we forgive, we don't want war. And Mairead and Betty Williams won the Nobel Peace Prize. The thing about Mairead is that she hasn't given up. She's traveled the world, the war zones of the world. 3 weeks ago, she and some friends were in Cyprus, rented a boat, and tried to get into Gaza to break Israel's, you know, stranglehold on Gaza and to violate the law. And they were arrested, and Mairead was jailed. And, you know, they can't kill her because she's a Nobel laureate. She was in jail, and there was big news in Europe, but not here in the United States. She was released. And she's going to come here, and she's connecting her life journey with Gaza and Iraq and everywhere else with New Mexico. And she's going to tell us how important New Mexico is for the whole planet. And spiritually, we have to work for a world of nonviolence, and that means we have a responsibility to get rid of nuclear weapons. Those of us who work at Los Alamos have to quit our jobs. The politicians, the media, all of us have to begin to unpack Obama's vision of a nuclear-free world. So come Friday night.
Father John Deere is author of his autobiography, A Persistent Peace, One Man's Struggle for a Nonviolent World, with a foreword by Martin Sheen. It's published by Loyola Press, and he published many other books as well. Friday night, the 31st of July, Witness for Peace, an evening with two Nobel Peace Prize laureates at 7 o'clock at the Santa Fe Convention Center, and then Saturday, the 1st of August, From 10 to noon, a nonviolent training session at Santa Maria de la Paz Church in Santa Fe, and then Pax Christi's annual sackcloth and ashes peace vigil at 2 p.m. at Ashley Pond in Los Alamos. The Nobel laureates will speak at 4 o'clock at Ashley Pond. Thank you so much for being with us on the Santa Fe Radio Cafe.
Thanks for having me, Mary Charlotte.
You've been listening to the Santa Fe Radio Cafe. My name is Mary Charlotte. KSFR streams live on the web at ksfr.org. I am reachable by email at radiocafe@ksfr.org. Stay tuned for the BBC, followed by local news by KSFR's award-winning news team. And after that, Good Morning Jazz with John Greenspan features co-DJ and Wall Street Journal music critic Terry Teachout, who's also the librettist for the new opera, The Letter, spinning some of his favorites. Broadcasting from the Santa Fe Baking Company, we'll see you tomorrow. Ciao.